Hello, and welcome to The Squeal, PIC's swine management podcast featuring in-depth conversations on topics that matter to you. PIC is the global leader in swine genetics. At PIC, our goal is to make our customers the most successful pig producers by providing them with the best genetics. We know our business success depends on yours. Today, we're bringing to the table a timely topic, endemic diseases, with our special guest, Dr. Bailey Aruda, with Iowa State's Diagnostic Laboratory, along with PIC's Dr. Jess Waddell and Dr. Maria Clavejo. And I'll ask each of you to introduce yourselves.
Dr. Bailey Aruda, diagnostic pathologist and assistant professor at the Iowa State University Diagnostic Laboratory.
Jess Waddell, PIC health assurance veterinarian.
Maria Clavejo, I'm a half-time health assurance veterinarian at PIC and also a half-time research assistant professor at the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab at ISU.
Talk about these endemic agents that are our focus at this current time. What types of disease do they cause, and what sort of issues do they bring? What are the symptoms?
So if you look at a you know, crude definition of endemic, it's just a pathogen or a disease that's under constant state within a population. Okay, so for some farms and for some regions, you might characterize endemic agents differently. So for some countries, Mycoplasma high pneumonia would be an endemic agent. In this case, for us at PAC in particular, we look at SIV or swine influenza virus and strep suis and HPS, PCV2 as those endemic. The other thing that I wanted to point out with this is these endemic pathogens, they're pathogens, right? But the interesting thing about those is that it's a spectrum of disease and how they cause disease. So you might have pathogens or strep suis strains that are commensal, will not cause disease, all the way to very highly pathogenic. And that presents an opportunity and a challenge to how to properly diagnose and how to control those, and that's why we're now focused on them. The second point is on the bacterial side, is that there's been a lot of pressure over the last couple of years to reduce the use of antibiotics, driven by a lot of public perception, but also a lot of regulatory, you know, instances with like the VFDs. So that has led to a decrease or a more pressure on producers to minimize use or to be more judicious when using antimicrobials. And I think that's refocused the attention on the endemic agents, which are the primary drivers of use.
On farm, Jess, how does that fit with what you're experiencing in the real world?
Yeah, the endemic agents continue when everything else is going well. Dr. Schwartz used to say disease abhors a vacuum, and those endemic agents, absent of all the other epidemic agents, will fill the void, and you'll see more and more of those strep suis, Haemophilus parasuis. When everything else is normal, it gets worse if you do have PRRS, obviously, but PRRS is then the primary factor, and we fix PRRS, and the endemic agents role decreases, it seems. But like I said, when everything else is normal, the endemic agents take they step forward and fill the void, the need for disease prevention.
You know, in the old days, it was a matter of, we've got thumping or coughing or we kind of went by whatever symptom was exhibited. And now our diagnostics have just so expanded and given us such good information. So how has that changed how we look at these diseases?
From a practitioner standpoint, it's leaps and bounds. Like there's so much more information, and now the challenge is, as a practitioner, we need to lean on the Iowa States, the University of Minnesota, etc., to help us interpret all of this new information, because it is such a difference from the practitioner standpoint of, we've got thumping pigs, polyseriocytis, let's get an ID on those pathogens and move forward.
Tell me about in the lab. What tools are you finding of greatest use today? Maybe it was something that wasn't even available 5 years ago.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of new tools today, and I think with every new tool that you add, you open up, you broaden your view of disease and disease pathogenesis and diagnosis. But you also have to understand the limitations of those tools as well. So right now we have a really great HPS PCR. That's really great to run on fibrin or joint fluid so that you can detect HPS when it's dead. So HPS is really fastidious, meaning it's really difficult to culture. So if you're relying on culture to identify polyseriocitis or arthritis due to HPS, you're probably going to get a lot of false negatives. So that's helpful in terms of detection and diagnosis. It's obviously not so helpful when you're hoping to further characterize the HPS or use it for an autogenous or look at antimicrobial sensitivity.
Bailey, can you comment? I think it was fascinating when you showed me this data on strep suis misdiagnosis or misclassification.
Yeah. Yep. So I think strep suis diagnosis and diagnoses, I think we've really oversimplified that just because you get an isolation of strep suis from any actually sample type, for instance, brain, joint, lung, that can be contamination. It's really very common to get strep suis because it's pretty much everywhere. So if you are relying only on culture results for a diagnosis, I think you could be missing important features, and you could be taking an isolate that's not necessarily associated with your issue and putting it into an autogenous. So if I looked at 50 cases from which strep suis was isolated from the brain, in 38% of those cases, there wasn't histologic lesions consistent with strep suis meningitis. If you further parse those out and say, okay, per-acute or terminal septicemia, you know, high growth of strep suis, then you actually are down to 32% of those cases that you are not seeing histologic lesions of a bacterial meningitis. Again, so that would suggest that we're getting a lot of false positives from our culture results of brain. So I think we really need to start looking into better ways of diagnosing strep suis systemic disease. And I think one of those ways would be submitting live intact pigs. I know that's not always possible, or submitting brain, liver, spleen, and culturing those and further characterizing those isolates via serotype or some other way. So, for instance, if you get a high growth from the brain, you get high growth from the spleen, you get high growth from the liver and or joint, and then you serotype those or you go on and do further characterization and, you know, a lot of them are the same, well, then I think your diagnostic confidence that that is the strep suis associated with your clinical disease increases. The other thing I've been working on in the lab is trying to take cerebral spinal fluid. And on the very limited number of samples that I've done this on, it looks like it's a pretty good and clean sample and really fairly easy to take that could be taken in the field and submitted for bacterial culture plus or minus cytology. So inclusion of that in any submission would likely increase your ability to identify the strep suis that is causing the meningitis.
So is that true across these three big endemic diseases we're talking about, that you need to make sure that you know which one you're talking about before you do the sampling that you're sending in?
For instance, I've started to do this now under the guidance of Dr. Mattson, because I think he's totally accurate in that we probably underdiagnose HPS when we do meningitis. So what I've started to do is either take that cerebral spinal fluid or bacterial swabs and forwarding them on to molecular for HPS PCR. And sometimes those guys will pop positive also. So looking into increasing our ability to diagnose HPS with meningitis, I think a PCR on the brain swab or cerebral spinal fluid will give us a more accurate answer.
Bailey, and do we see the same misclassification with HPS? Can you easily contaminate if the practitioner is doing it in the field and trying to just collect a brain swab? Can we have the same issue pop up as strep suis with HPS?
You know, I haven't looked really hard at the data at that, but I would say it's highly unlikely given the fastidious nature of HPS.
How do we get from where we are today to where we need to be in order to make the best use of these tools that we have developed and are developing so that we send the right samples? When we're in the field, that's not someone from the lab usually who has said, oh, we need this piece, and this piece. It's, you know, very specific in the lab's mind, and in the field's mind, it's, yeah, we're getting what we think that they want.
Yeah. And I think it takes... And I think the pathologists and diagnosticians at the VDL do a tremendous job in aiding the customer and educating. Ned, I think a big portion of this is education of swine practitioners and field vets, that we help them understand the limitations and the processes that need to be in place to accurately first detect the appropriate isolate and the isolate that's relevant for that case, but also interpret the results and limitations of those samplings.
So in the VDLs currently, how many of your samples are wasted, are not sufficient to accomplish what you're trying to do?
I don't know if I want to answer that one.
Well,
I think there's always room for continuous improvement, and I think education of submitters is essential in that. And also, direct communication with veterinarians. I've talked to a lot of veterinarians that'll look at a case and say, oh, it's strep suis disease. And I look at that same case and I say, I don't quite think that you have strong evidence to make that conclusion, especially when you don't have meningitis and you're isolating strep suis from the brain or, you know, and you look at the back T sheet. And what we're able to do as pathologists is look at the back T sheet and see how contaminated that sample is, because we can see all the other bugs that they happen to be streaking out on the plate and identifying. And so a lot of those will have numerous other agents being isolated by bacterial culture. So I think it is really a teamwork in terms of communicating what we would really like to see if you're looking for a strep suis case, or you're looking for strep suis and you say, hey, we need... Really, if you're looking at neurologic disease or systemic disease, intact pigs are by far and away, I think, the best way to go after that. If you can't do that, maybe do cerebral spinal fluid on nursery pigs, which commonly is where you see strep suis meningitis, as well as the head and then intact joints. Throw in spleen and liver, lung. For isolation, and I think you have a really good chance of identifying that strep suis, as well as histologic evaluation. I'm a pathologist, I'm biased, but I think it can provide some good information in terms of ability to cause disease and lesions in those pigs. So I would say overall, our submissions are good, but they can always be better. So really focusing on your question, I want a strep suis isolate for an autogenous, well, then you should probably send in a decent number of samples and then follow up with serotyping or some other characterization so that we know that it's consistent across those pigs, or, you know, perhaps it's different across the pigs, but it's within pigs, it's the same strep suis.
So if we were going to guess and we said, well, 80% of the samples are good, how far off would we be?
I guess, what's your definition of good?
I think the practitioner or the field veterinarian first define the goal. So if the goal is just to detect or not detect certain pathogens, I think our samples are 80% is probably accurate. Now, if you're going after an autogenous, we're probably way under submitting. But that, with the help of these two gals, their ability to characterize those multiple different endemic agents, be able to classify commensal versus pathogenic, will only help drive those practitioners to submit more samples, as Bailey indicated, from different locations within the pig, different pigs, multiple pigs, and multiple samples, whether it's brain, intact joints, etc. And then they'll see the value and can justify spending more time and money to submit those samples.
Since we're doing these things the way that we're doing them now with the information that we can acquire now, what additional information beyond just the sample are you needing in order to be most successful with your diagnosis?
I think now that we've started, and we'll talk a little bit about this later on the endemic, on the PAC endemic initiative, we've realized how crucial it is to provide, let's call it epidemiological data associated to that isolate. So when we refer to that, it's what's the age of the pig, in a barn, how many pigs were affected by that pig that you're submitting or that clinical presentation that you're observing and you're sending into the lab. Of course, the farm location, the premise ID, or premises ID, the sample type, right? What are you submitting? And having all of that information is vital to piece out the clinical outcome or relevance of that isolate and that detection in that case. As humans, we like to see things in a vacuum, and we don't understand that pigs are infected with multiple diseases. It's difficult sometimes to tease out the primary pathogen. So I think that combining all of this data when you submit is crucial, and to allow them or to show them why it is relevant to provide this information.
You mentioned a little earlier the potential for a practitioner or someone in the field to jump to a conclusion without sufficient information is always there. I need an answer in a hurry. I need to begin treatment. It's always there. It's always a time crunch. But to think about, I need to be able or willing to be wrong in that hip holster analysis. I need to think more about, well, what else could it be rather than I know what this is. So how much of an issue is that in our, we called it educational process, to get people past the idea of, well, I've seen this 1,000 times, I know what this is, versus, yeah, but this is only a part of the problem we're experiencing here. Can we push through that? Is that what we're teaching our young vets to be about? How are we improving on that?
I think that's a good point, and it may actually be that we're not jumping to conclusions, but obviously the initial standpoint is triage, work for the pigs, save the pigs, make sure our isolate is not resistant to the specific antibiotic we're going to implement. But then to be more forward thinking that long term, what am I going to do in this flow? We can't just run antibiotics all the time. So as the autogenous vaccines have improved, be thinking about that piece during the triage, that long term, what are we going to do for this flow of pigs to make them the healthiest and those customers the most successful?
From your perspective? With this two jobs working together, one on the industry side, one on the diagnostic side, what are the challenges that you see in bringing those two together? I mean, you're, to a certain extent, you are an interpreter in understanding that information and how it goes both ways. So what would you say are the challenges?
Yeah, I would phrase it as the opportunities that we have at the diagnostic lab are definitely on the educational side. I think, and the way I think we should approach it is by showing them what can be done when you do provide the data, or you do submit the appropriate samples and set of tissues. The customer immediately sees the value in that.
Joining us on The Squeal for this first episode looking at endemic disease was Iowa State's Dr. Bailey Aruda and our PIC swine health professionals, Dr. Maria Clavejo and Dr. Jess Waddell. You're welcome to share these podcasts widely in your organization. In fact, we encourage it. For PIC, the international leader of continuous genetic improvement in swine breeding stock and in world-class technical support to the global pork supply chain, I'm Ned Arthur. Thanks for joining us.